I appreciate that, and I do appreciate the opportunity to speak before you this afternoon. And to begin my thoughts, I'd like to at least briefly discuss the figure of the 19th century philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson. Some of you may be familiar with Mr. Emerson and his works, although admittedly I know I wasn't until I began putting these thoughts together. Ralph Waldo Emerson was a leader of the Transcendentalist movement in the 1800s during his lifetime, and I imagine that there's a few things we'd probably agree with Mr. Emerson on, but there's quite a few things I don't think we would see eye to eye with him. Although a believer in God and of Christ, Mr. Emerson held a rather dim view as it pertained to organized religion and the church and how man gains his relationship with the Father. And it was out of these beliefs that he held and the subsequent backlash that he experienced that Mr. Emerson wrote, "Let me never fall into the vulgar mistake of dreaming that I am persecuted whenever I am contradicted." Now, this is one of his more well-known quotes, and obviously a pretty pointed criticism of Christians of his time, who he felt couldn't deal with criticism or couldn't deal with people who felt differently than them without feeling as if they were being persecuted. And strangely enough, or perhaps not strangely, depending how you look at it, this is a quote that has found new life today. You can go online and find many articles and blog posts that look to this quote as an accurate description of how people feel about the church today, that we lack the ability to deal with people who disagree with us without feeling as if we are being persecuted. And consideration of this type of criticism as it pertains to our faith can be uncomfortable. I think oftentimes it can be frustrating, but I do think it's an endeavor worth exploring. Many times I think considering this type of criticism simply speaks to how worldly the world has become, but sometimes I do think it's worthwhile to consider what the world thinks about us, the views that they hold of us. And sometimes I do think that there can be a kernel of truth contained there, as I believe is the case with Mr. Emerson's quote here. And that's because persecution is a topic that contains a great deal of confusion. I think that all of us could collectively agree upon a rather rough understanding of what persecution is, but I doubt that we would all be able to agree on what things are and what things aren't persecution. I would imagine there'd be some form of disagreement there. And oftentimes in the world, you'll see that one party will say something's persecution, the other will say that it's simple disagreement, and oftentimes two groups on opposite ends of an argument will both believe that they're the persecuted party. But we as Christians know that we will be persecuted. But does that allow us to say that we're actively persecuted? Or are we falling into the trap that Mr. Emerson described when he said that it's easy for us to look at simple disagreement and call it persecution? And does it really matter? Does it matter if we define persecution perhaps too broadly? And so today, that's the idea that I would like to explore, the topic of persecution. And in doing so, the main goals I have are to look at persecution and see how the Bible defines it, what it tells us about persecution and what we can expect. Then from there, discuss if we are persecuted, then to what degree are we persecuted, both in terms of frequency as well as severity. And then lastly, considering those two points, how we define persecution and if we are persecuted and to what degree, where does that lead us? What can we glean from that and what can we apply to our lives? So to begin with, I'd like to discuss a pair of verses that I think set our expectations towards persecution perhaps better than any others. And I'll only be on these briefly, so you don't necessarily have to turn there. But they're going to be Matthew chapter 5, verse 10, and 2 Timothy 3 and 12. Now, Matthew 5 and 10 reads, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And then 2 Timothy 3 and 12 reads, "Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Jesus Christ will suffer persecution." And I believe that these two verses set our expectations as Christians towards persecution perhaps more so than any other verses in the Bible. I know there's many other verses out there that share these same sentiments, Luke 21 and 12 or John 15 and 20, for example. But by my estimation, these are the most cited verses when it comes towards our expectations towards persecution, or at the least sum it up most concisely in that, one, we understand that godly Christians will suffer persecution, and two, that the reward for suffering that persecution is the kingdom of heaven. But what these verses don't do on their own is define what exactly persecution is. And without us doing that, without us looking elsewhere in Scripture and understand what persecution is as the Bible defines it, we find ourselves in an easy position to fall in the trap that Mr. Emerson was describing, and that it's very easy for us to apply too broad of a term towards persecution. And that's for two reasons. It's because, one, when we do that, when we apply too broad of a term, or when we look at persecution as if it's something that perhaps we're not really experiencing, that serves to legitimize our faith. We look at it and we say that if we're suffering persecution for Christ's sake, then we must be living a godly lifestyle. And two, it allows us to have that hope or the promise of the kingdom of heaven. And that puts us in a position that's rather tricky, because then it's almost as if we want to suffer persecution. Or at the least, we want to believe that our difficulties and our struggles are persecution, so we can have the rewards and the belief as described here. But aside from the fact that I don't believe you can reverse engineer that, so to speak, and say that because you're being persecuted, you must be living a godly lifestyle, I don't think you can necessarily say that. Beyond that, simply applying too broad of a term towards persecution doesn't guarantee you these things. It just simply guarantees you that the world will view us as Ralph Waldo Emerson viewed the Christians of his time, as ineffective and unable to deal with disagreement towards what we believe. And also puts us in a difficult position in that persecution, or the belief of persecution, carries with it a great deal of negative psychological issues. I think it's common to see that groups of people who are persecuted oftentimes end up withdrawing from the world. They kind of collapse in on themselves as a group and avoid really sharing their beliefs or sharing their faith. And when we subject ourselves to an opinion that we're persecuted, when we're not, we're subjecting ourselves to those types of feelings needlessly. And we're causing ourselves to, unfortunately, if we're not careful, withdraw from the world when really we don't have to. And so then, knowing that there's a downside to misclassifying persecution, I'd like to consider how we can actually define it. And I will say that this is my personal view on how I believe the Bible defines persecution. In order to come up with this definition, if you will, I did go through all the instances in my New King James where persecution is mentioned and considered what exactly it was talking about in that instance, what it was describing there. And I will admit that in doing so, I came up with a rather narrow definition of persecution, which, again, I believe is how the Bible would define it. And I could see an argument being made for perhaps a slightly more broader application of the term persecution. But I will say that regardless of how broadly or narrowly you define it, I think in going through this you'll see that for something to be considered persecution, there is a connecting thread there that connects all the different types of it. And if that's not there, I don't think we can call it persecution, but we'll discuss that here in a few moments. So to begin with then, in terms of how we define persecution, I think a logical place to turn to is the Greek. And the most commonly Greek or most commonly used Greek word in the Bible for persecution is the word dioko, which literally means to pursue, which that's the root word of our English persecution, is that pursue. The idea of driving a group of people out, putting them to flight, or just simply forcing them out of an area. And it's a type of persecution we see many times in the Bible. Think of an Acts with Paul and Barnabas, about how they were driven from Antioch to Iconium to Lystra, and then again later on from Thessalonica to Berea and Athens. And we see Christ warn the apostles about this type of persecution in Matthew 10:23. When they persecute you in this city, flee to another. As well as in Matthew 23:34. Therefore indeed I send you prophets, wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city. And this is the type of persecution we see today in many places. In the Middle East, with places like Iraq, Christian groups are just simply forced out. They're just simply persecuted and forced out of an area, and that's really the goal behind that persecution, is they particularly don't care where they go as long as they're forcing them out of whatever area they're holding. Now, beyond then looking at the Greek and understanding what, in my mind, that defines the term or describes the type of persecution, I find that probably the most other useful way of approaching this is to look at prophetical uses of the term persecution. When we can look at a spot where the Lord says or Christ says that someone will suffer persecution, and then we can look and see what that became, that really helps us to understand how the Bible is defining persecution in that moment. And a good example of this is Deuteronomy chapter 30. And again, you don't necessarily have to turn there, but this passage is in the middle of Moses renewing the children of Israel's covenant with the Lord at Moab, as prescribed by the Lord. And the first few verses there in chapter 30, we see that Moses is telling them about how the Lord is promising to return the children of Israel from bondage back to the land of promise. And he says there, "Also the Lord your God will put all these curses on your enemies and all those who hate you, who persecuted you." Now, seeing then that the Lord is describing what the children of Israel are going to have happen to them at the hands of the Babylonians, that he's describing that as persecution, then we can consider, what did that look like? And obviously, this included, obviously there was a great deal of war and famine and many people that died in the Babylonian captivity or in the capture of the children of Israel. But I think really what it's getting at here is the actual captivity itself. And I know that's what Isaiah 14 and 6 also calls persecution as well. And then in considering what that looked like, I think an excellent place to look is the first few chapters of the book of Daniel. In there we see Daniel with the Babylonians in captivity, and there they're not seeking to end Daniel's life, but rather they're trying to change him. They're trying to change him from a children of Israel, from a Jew, and make him into a Babylonian. And this was common practice for the Babylonians. It was very typical that whenever they conquered a certain area, conquered a city or group of people, that they would take those people and disperse them all throughout their kingdom, put new people in, and in doing so, they weren't trying to end those people existentially, but rather they were trying to get them to change. They're trying to take whatever identity they had, their religion, their culture, and change them from that into a Babylonian. And I think that really describes in one of the main forms or definitions of persecution is that it's simply trying to force a change upon a group of people. And necessarily not end those people existentially again, but just force them to change away from what they are into what you want them to be. And this is again a certain type of persecution we see very often today. In places, especially in the Middle East and Africa, Christians are dying off, or Christianity is dying there, not because the Christians are dying, but because simply there's so much pressure and so much force being applied upon them that they're just abandoning the faith and just converting back to, in most cases, back to Islam. Now, beyond then considering that, what I would describe again to be another form of the definition of persecution, and using that same approach of looking at prophetical uses of the term persecution, we can look at John 15 and 20, and this is Christ speaking here when he says, "Remember the word that I said to you. A servant is not greater than their master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you." Now, we can consider then, how was Christ persecuted? Through crucifixion and death. Or we can look at Matthew 5 and 12, where Christ describes again to the apostles how they should be expected, that they need to expect to be persecuted as the prophets were, who again were put to death or were sought to be put to death. And these passages, as well as many others, really tell us what I think we already all know, that one of the main forms of persecution, again, one of what I would view as the three parts of the definition, is simply trying to put a group of people or a particular person to death. And there's other passages that I think make that abundantly clear, that when the term persecution is used, that's what it's referring to. A good example of those is in many of the Psalms of David. He's describing the persecution that he had to deal with at the hands of Saul. And obviously we know that Saul was seeking to put him to death. And there's also many where I think it's implied. Matthew 10, 21 and 22, Matthew 23, 24, Luke 21, 16, Luke 11, 49, just to name a few. And I think that the far majority of time in the Bible, or at least I would say around half of the time, when the term persecution is used in the Bible, it is referring to this, towards trying to put a group of people to death. And again, this is obviously a form of persecution that we see today to a stunning degree. Christians are actually put to death for their faith more so than any other religious group around the world. And last year there were over 4,000 Christians who were put to death because of their faith all around the world. Now then, in considering these three things, or the three ways that I think persecution is defined biblically, one, when it's used to describe forcing a group out, two, when it's trying to force a group to change, and three, trying to put a group of people or an individual to death, I think we can see that the connecting thread that really underlines all of those is the idea that it's trying to end an idea or a practice. And these are the three ways that we see persecution described in doing, and that it's forcing a group of people out of an area, forcing them to change, or simply putting them to death. And beyond that, I struggle to really see any other things fit that definition. But I can see an argument being made towards a little bit more broad application of the term, a little bit more flexibility here. I know a common one is with mockery. Mockery is often used, described oftentimes back-to-back or hand-in-hand with persecution in the scripture, so many people look at mockery as a form of persecution. I tend to believe that it doesn't necessarily mean persecution there, but I could see the argument be made that it is a form of persecution, but regardless, I do think that it still has to carry that connecting thread of the goal being tried to end an idea or of a belief, and that's where really the mockery that we deal with, I don't think fits the bill. Because the majority of the time when people are mocking us for our faith, they aren't seeking to try to force us to abandon our faith or discourage others. They're really just trying to have a laugh at our expense, as far as I can tell. And while that's certainly uncomfortable and certainly doesn't forgive the action, I don't think it meets the definition of persecution. Whereas I do think an argument could be made for Christ's mockery that he dealt with during his crucifixion as being a form of persecution. And I believe that because I think that crucifixion was made to be a public spectacle in order to dissuade other people from committing whatever crime or whatever accusation was against the person being put to death. It was trying to dissuade other people from doing that. That's why it was made to be such a horrific public event. In that same fashion, I think that Christ's mockery may have fallen into the same category, that they would mock him in that way as if they probably did at many a crucifixion, again, in order to dissuade other people from doing that. But nevertheless, then, I do think that the majority of mockery we face probably doesn't meet that definition. So then, if we take that as our definition of persecution, again, that it's trying to force an end of an idea or belief through driving someone off, forcing a change upon them, or putting them to death, we can ask ourselves, are we persecuted? To which the answer, I believe, is yes. I think 2 Timothy is clear in that it tells us that we as Christians, as believing and practicing Christians, can expect to be persecuted. But there are many degrees to persecution, both in terms of frequency and in terms of severity. And in terms of frequency, I think that persecution can really fall into three broad buckets. One, I think persecution can be institutional in nature. We see that in places such as North Korea today, which is regarded as having the most extreme form of persecution anywhere in the world against Christians. And there, the government makes the persecution of Christians so horrific and so extreme and so pervasive that it really just shapes every aspect of life for a Christian. I would imagine if we saw a believing Christian who was in North Korea, we wouldn't recognize him because of the amount of pressure that's applied upon them. And I think an example of that in biblical times would be the church in Rome under the rule of Nero. I know there was many different degrees of persecution under the different emperors, but under Nero, I think it really fit the definition of state-sponsored institutional persecution that really impacted them to an extreme degree. Now, beyond that, I think the second form in terms of frequency of persecution is when it's just frequent in nature. And a rather odd example of this today is actually in Mexico. That in Mexico, Christians can expect to come into persecution in the form of when they run into cartels who they refuse to go along with their criminal schemes and enterprises. And it's not uncommon for Christians down there to, when they refuse to go along with whatever the cartels are trying to force upon them, that they have to deal with sometimes horrific persecution. And we've seen that in the news recently in terms of the murder of several individuals down there. And again, I don't believe it's quite to the level of state-sponsored or quite as pervasive as it is in other regions around the world, but it is something they have to deal with, and unfortunately at times extremely have to deal with, on at least a frequent basis. In terms of biblical example, I think some of the early churches under the different emperors other than Nero would fit that definition as well. I think that the church at Thessalonica is an excellent example of this, how shortly after we see Paul leave there, we see that the church, actually while Paul was there as well, that they come under persecution at the hand of the Gentiles. And while we don't get the sense that it's quite as constant or as serious or severe as it is later on under Nero, for example, with the Romans, it is something that we get the sense is a fairly regular thing that they had to deal with. And then lastly, I believe that persecution can just be infrequent in nature. And that is what I believe we face as Christians here in America. Because if we apply a strict definition of persecution, again, how I believe the Bible defines it, and we weed out simple awkwardness and simple disagreement, we find that persecution for us is really quite rare. And I know for me anyways, I can hardly think of many times at all where I would have come in contact with that. And I think too often it's just simply people who aren't accepting Christ. And I think it's very easy for us to fall into the trap described by Ralph Waldo Emerson that when someone rejects Christ, that we look at that as persecution, but it just simply doesn't fit the bill. And I also think it's very easy for us, if we're not careful, to look at the changing public opinion and the changing laws of our country and view that as a form of persecution, which, again, I don't think fits the bill because the far majority of the time, it's not trying to force a change upon us. It's not trying to force the ending of that idea or practice. But obviously, the legalization of sin is frustrating, but I don't think it fits the definition of persecution. And perhaps there are a few times and a few examples that we've seen where it blends that line and all of a sudden it might be persecution, but I don't think we should get so caught up in just a very, very small handful of individuals who ultimately, as we've seen, the courts have ruled in their favor. Now, as I mentioned before, I think that persecution can vary not only in frequency, but also in severity. And if we honestly consider our own persecution, either persecution that we've experienced or we think we may experience, if we were to rate that on a scale of 1 to 10, I at least know for myself, I couldn't rate that anything beyond a 1. Especially when I consider what many groups of Christians face in terms of persecution every day around the world, considering that many of the simple things we've enjoyed today are illegal in many nations. Consider that in Libya, it's actually even illegal to own a Bible. In Afghanistan, many Christian converts from Islam are actually forced against their will into insane asylums under the guise of only someone who's mentally ill would abandon Islam for Christianity. In Pakistan, there's many Christians who sit on death row for the crime of blaspheming against Muhammad. And as North Korea, as I mentioned before, it is almost impossible for Christians to exist at all to such a degree that Christians frequently don't even tell their own children about their faith until they're old enough that they can be at least somewhat encouraged that they won't succumb to state-sponsored coercion and brainwashing. And that's just simply a handful of nations. Christians remain the most persecuted religious group in the entire world. And as I mentioned before, are put to death annually at a higher rate than any other group of religious group out there. But we aren't in Libya. We aren't in Afghanistan, Pakistan, or North Korea. But rather, we are in a country that is the most advantageous for Christians in the entire world. And by my estimation, the most advantageous situation that there's ever been for Christians. And too often, I think we lose sight of that. Too often, I think we lose that perspective, and we need to regain that. And that idea of perspective, of understanding and viewing our persecution that we deal with in this country correctly, accurately, grounded in reality, is the answer to the question I posed earlier of what I think we can gain by understanding what persecution is and the degree to which we're persecuted. And ultimately, I think it's vital that we regain that perspective. That's for a few different reasons. One, when we fail to have that proper perspective, when we view ourselves as being persecuted beyond reality, we fall into the trap that Ralph Waldo Emerson described, and we are viewed by the world the way he viewed them. We're viewed as ineffective, unable to deal with people disagreeing with us, and I think we can relate to those feelings. Think about how we feel about groups of people whenever they seem to think they're persecuted beyond what we estimate they really are. We think they're ridiculous. And we don't take them seriously. But that's how the world views us when we view ourselves as being persecuted beyond reality. And when we do that, when we take that viewpoint, I believe that we do a disservice to the gospel, and we do a disservice to ourselves, and we come across as, frankly, ungrateful. And that leads me to the second reason why I think this perspective is so important, is because if we view ourselves as under constant and serious persecution, beyond what we really are, we are just absolutely turning our backs on all the blessings that we really have, and we are absolutely losing sight of that. Again, I don't think there's any disputing the fact that we are the most blessed group of Christians that have ever existed in the history of mankind. There just simply has never been a combination of Christians that enjoy the religious freedom that we do, as well as just the abundance of blessings we have, both materially and in terms of time. And how could we not be emboldened by that? How could we not take advantage of that? But when we view ourselves as persecuted beyond what we really are, that's exactly what we do. We turn away from these blessings and we haul up away from the world and we fail to take advantage of them. But rather, we need to remember that to whom much is given, much will be required. And to whom has more been given than us. And therefore, to whom will be more required of than us. And that's really what I believe this perspective gives us. Boldness. Knowing that we have been given more and are facing less adversity than anyone else. And because of that, we must take advantage. And even if you think times are changing, even if you think the Christians of tomorrow are facing more persecution than the Christians of today, if you think that this country will be unrecognizable in the generations to come, then all the more reason to be bold today. And as public opinion does shift, as people abandon the faith of us and our parents and grandparents, as they move away from these held beliefs, and there's less and less groups of people who attend believing bodies, that doesn't necessarily mean more persecution, but it definitively means that there are more people every day in need of the gospel message than the day before. It doesn't mean more persecution, but it definitely means opportunity. And opportunity means expectations. And we need to make sure that we have the proper perspective and the boldness in order to meet those expectations. So today, that's the extent of my thoughts. I hope that in considering these, you've gained a better idea of what persecution is as the Bible defines it. gain an understanding to what degree we're persecuted, and then hopefully, above all, gain that perspective and boldness that I think we need to have. And at this time now, we'll extend the gospel invitation. If there's anyone here who's outside the body of Christ and wishes to accept him at this time, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing the invitation hymn.